I call this House Finance Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect it is 1:42 PM. And I appreciate the patience, everyone showing patience here. We got a late start, but that happens sometimes. Today we will have, let's see, first I'll get, I'll take a deep breath, and then I'm going to say who's here. Our roll call today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Staff, Representative Colomb, Representative Ortiz, Representative Prock, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Edgman, myself, Co-Chair Johnson. Our LIO moderator today is Emily Mesh, and our committee secretary is Leah Frazier. Today we are going to hear a presentation on the proposed FY25 budget for the Department of Revenue. And we have Eric DeMolin, Administrative Services Director, here in the room with us to do the presentation. We also online have Commissioner Crum, Department of Revenue, Devin Mitchell, the Executive Director and CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We have Brian Butcher, the Executive Director and CEO of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Steve Williams, Chief Executive Officer of the Mental Health Trust, Stephanie Wheeler, who is a long-term care ombudsman. Members may feel free to ask questions throughout the presentation. I try to like to at least keep them at the end of the page. I don't know that we're in a, I guess that's the only thing we really have today, so we shouldn't have to rush too quickly. Mr. DeMolin, if you would like to come forward, place yourself on the record and state your affiliation, you may proceed.
Thank you. For the record, Eric DeMolin, Admin Services Director for the Department of Revenue. Today we're going to be covering the FY25 Governor's Amended Budget Overview. And online with me today, I do have Commissioner Adam Crum, and I would like to hand it over to him, and he'll just go through a brief introduction, and I'll get through the details of our budget presentation.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. I appreciate you having us here today to go over the Department of Revenue, our 2025 government budget. As we go over this, on slide two, you can see the overall agenda about the overview, the budget priorities, our year-over-year budget comparison, as well as the corporations and authorities. If we go to slide three, as we look at this for the department overview, our mission is to collect, distribute, invest funds for public purposes. That's the bare bones aspect of what we do with the Department of Revenue. Trying to do this under our high values, the agencies we have, our tax division, treasury, permanent fund dividend division, child support enforcement, and the commissioner's office. Outside of that, we do have a number of corporations and authorities, and we've got a couple of statewide items that we are responsible for sharing. And then as we go down to slide four with the organization aspect, you can see how this is set up. Under the Department of Revenue with the Commissioner's Office over the top of the roughly five divisions and then the overall authorities. And those are all either trustee or board seats for the Commissioner of Revenue, as well as a number of other boards that we do, which really make up a great deal of the budget that we're going to be going over. So with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Mr. DeMolin to go through the rest of the presentation on the number side. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your graciousness for letting me call.
Thank you. For the record, Eric DeMolin, Admin Services Director for the Department of Revenue. As we get into our presentation, we've got a few just overall budget overview slides that show just a high-level picture where DOR sits to the statewide comparison for general fund appropriations. This is a legislative finance division slide. We just like to highlight where we stand with the GF allocations. The second slide on our budget overview is just a visual representation of how our funding is comprised within DOR. You can see just by the size of the columns that the majority of our funding is in that other category, which is going to be either interagency receipts or other fund sources outside of general fund, such as the ARM board for managing TERS and PERS funds. I want to take a brief pause here just to see if there's any general questions about how the Department of Revenue's cumulative total budget composition is laid out or how that works.
While the co-chair steps up for a few minutes, I'm pinch hitting for any questions. Representative Kronk? Representative Hannon?
Thank you. Through the co-chair, Mr. DeMolin, there's a dramatic drop between the FY24 management plan and the governor's adjusted base in the other category, and I assume you're going to draw our attention to that later on, or is there a theme that links that?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So this is a technical change item that's causing the discrepancy. I think we could have maybe put a start item to kind of illustrate what we're seeing here. But this is it's a decrease that includes multi-year reversals through AHFC, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, of COVID and federal dollars. So it's not a really good representation of a change over a year-over-year operational budget.
Thank you
for the question.
And it's also, if I might, the first year that the department's not managing the power cost equalization fund. I don't know what bearing that has on that decrease of positions, but it must have some.
Yeah, so through the chair, Representative Edgemond, when we're looking at not managing PCE anymore, it didn't have a direct correlation to our appropriated budget or what we're seeing here. We build a lot of just efficiencies within that division. So if we're looking at economies of scale, when we are looking at a total portfolio basis, the amount of money that's transferred out to the Permanent Fund Corporation outside of the Treasury didn't warrant a decrease in staff or resources. So it remained relatively steady.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
So there's a couple of items the Department of Revenue wanted to highlight for the legislature this year as our budget priorities. And the first one is our child support enforcement class study implementation. this has been a really big win for our department. The Child Force Enforcement Division Child Support Specialist job class has had over a 20% vacancy over the last couple of years. They've been effectively managing through that vacancy, keeping that program up and running. And we were able to complete a class study that went into effect December 25th that effectively gave two range increments to this job class series, which is actually greatly increasing the amount of applications that we're seeing. So we're hopeful that we'll see this vacancy rate that has been embedded in this particular job class will hopefully go down over the next 60 days. We'll see some positive impacts there.
And on that topic, Representative Gelvin.
Thanks so much. I think it's a win for Alaska, as I think you'll be able to hopefully feel supported and get to the lower vacancy. But my question is about, through the chair, if I might, I think it sounded like the job classifications moved up two rankings, as I understand. And I'm curious to know what percentage of a pay raise that is. I know that in other areas of your department, there was a 5% COLA, and I'm wondering if this is comparable to that.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, it's definitely more than the 5% COLA. So when we're looking at the two ranges, I couldn't tell you offhand.
Okay.
But I could definitely report back. But I would say it'd be closer to the 15-20%.
Through the chair, as a follow-up comment, and that makes sense to me given what I know that those jobs involve. That is a state job, and happy to hear that hopefully you'll be able to get more support in that area. Thank you.
The next item that we have that we wanted to highlight is our Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Just looking at their budget over the last 5 years, the dividend has just seen operational costs increase. The division is very inelastic when it comes to some of these operational inputs. The best example of one of our rising costs is postage. USPS increased postage rates by 3 cents per stamp this last year, and the PFD division utilizes that Central Mail Service quite a bit.
That's interesting, because we have the director in the audience. It would be really interesting, with the indulgence of the committee, if she would come to the table and maybe talk to us a little bit about how things have shifted to electronic distribution of payments and things of that sort, because it was my recollection, which goes back a couple of years, that more people across the state get their PFDs now through electronic deposits than the traditional sort of mailing out of a check. But if you might be able to put yourself on the record and address that, please.
For the record, Genevieve Watusik, Permanent Fund Dividend Director. That is correct, Chair Edgman. So over 80% are online filers, but that still leaves 20% that are not. We still have lots of folks that want correspondence through writing. You get to check a box. Do you want us to email you? Do you want us to send you paper? And then we also send over 50,000 paper warrants a year. Most are still doing electronic direct deposits, but over 50,000 warrants go out a year for folks that want that route. And then also we send over 200,000 1099s a year. So that's a lot of folks, and that's at 66 cents a piece of mail. That's a lot of mail.
So what did you say the ratio was in terms of people receiving their checks, you know, vis-a-vis mail and electronic deposits?
Over 500,000 do direct deposit, but it's about 40 to 55,000 that do want it by paper check a year.
So is that that's not 80 to 20 ratio?
So over 80% file online, but you can decide if, when you file online, if you want a paper check or if you would like a direct deposit. And then if you file by paper, same.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Edgman, to the chair. Why can't you just electronically send them their 1099?
We do for those that choose that option, but for those that want written correspondence, by law, we do need to send those either way. And if they want it by written communication, we do mail those out for them. And over 200,000 have elected for that option.
I have a quick follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Edgman, through the chair. How's that process work? I mean, do they default into the electronic and then they have to request the paper, or do they default into the paper and have to request the electronic?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. You get to choose when you do file. We ask you what type of communication you would like, and so you have to tell us. Otherwise, we will reach out to you to ask either by call or by email. Of course, we would prefer that, and then by paper.
One last follow-up. Thank you, Co-Chair Edgman, to the chair. is it possible to default them into the electronic and then take an action to say they want paper, or no?
Through the chair, Representative Staff, you do not have to provide an email address to us. That's not one of the required fields on the application, so yes and no.
Gotcha. Thanks.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Just for my own interest, I kind of presume that the 20% who do not file electronically are probably largely the group that are also the 50,000 warrants that get mailed, or have you guys correlated that? And
through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's correct. More so if you're filing by paper, you are also requesting a paper warrant. Also, if you're receiving a previous year's, if you were undetermined or were a prior year filer, and that's the 0 to 18-year-olds that their parents forgot a year, and you're getting it between your 18th and 20th birthdays, you're going to be getting that by warrant as well. That's a small percentage, but there's just those one-offs, and then also the estate applications. If you're filing an application on behalf of an Alaskan that's passed away, usually those can buy paper warrant too because they go to the estate, the trust.
Yeah, and through the chair, I guess my thought is, you know, I appreciate us always looking for efficiency, but it's always in the back of my mind. The number of Alaskans, and I'm, you know, the people who don't have bank accounts for direct deposit, people who do not have permanent homes to do it to, probably don't have email and adequate internet. And I appreciate the fact that you guys continue to serve them and we have this paper filing. And I guess I'm just asking us to think in the names of efficiency, we don't want to leave out or leave behind the Alaskans who this is the most critical income to them, and to not create barriers that would default and leave them behind when they have the same legal right and obligation to receive that money. And I generally hear from those folks because they walk in and file at the office, and they're very appreciative to get that help to have that file, paper filing.
Thank you. And just one comment on that. Thank you, Representative Hannon. We also incentivize folks to apply online and get a direct deposit by they get their payment in the first payment run in October, whereas those that file by paper or would like a paper check, it's 2 weeks later. And that's continuing our paper light, not paper less mission to continue down that path to cost save and encourage.
Additional comments or questions? Not hearing any. Thank you for coming to the table.
For the record, Eric DeMullen, Admin Services Director, Department of Revenue. Now we're moving into the part of the presentation where we get into each one of the department overview divisions, and we'll touch on some of the major cost drivers for each of the core divisions within the Department of Revenue. So the first division, First division is the tax division, and the first item that we have listed is an increment for $1,037,000 for the tax management system, the TRIM system that we currently have for with Fast Enterprises. And this is a system that collects and accounts for all taxes throughout the state of Alaska. The second item that we have for the tax division is an increment of $102,000, and this is for operational requirements that they have to remain compliant. So one thing that the tax division does have to do is make sure for publication 1075 is to go and visit offsite data centers and ensure compliance. We also need to be able to go and do audit activities for state of Alaska tax matters. And the last item that we have for consideration is $96,500, and this is for economic research. So this is specifically for a tool called REMI that we use. And what this is doing is it's upgrading its capability to be able to go more granular to more rural state of Alaska boroughs. So when we're looking at drafting fiscal notes or seeing economic impacts on proposed legislation, or if we get these inquiries, we could get better, more granular data. Next division that we have is the Treasury division. Specific to the Treasury, we don't have any major component changes for this year. The way the Treasury operates is that it does provide services to the ARM board. So as we get into the next slide, I see the two as being related. So for the ARM board side of our budget, we've got a few different requests and increments for this year. The first one is to maintain investment data services. As we get contract renewals coming up, inflation has driven the cost up of some of the tools that we use to manage assets across the state. Examples would include Bloomberg, Moody's, or Fitch. The second item that we have is unbudgeted costs for the 5% COLA for the Treasury Division. When the legislature moved forward HB 226, we did get an increment within the Treasury component in the IA to allow billing the ARM board. We did not, however, see an increment in the actual ARM board to accommodate that billing. So this is something we're putting forward just to bring that into balance. It doesn't cause any budgetary constraints within the ARM board. The last item that we have is adding authority to fund interagency receipts for salary adjustments. Next division is the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Already mentioned, this is one of our budget priorities for this year. So the first one for $90,000 is for legal and adjudication services. As we're seeing more fraud attempts, and we've seen that happen year over year, we just have a need for more of these services through OAH and DOA and with the Department of Law, and we've seen those costs increase. The second item we've already spoken to a little bit here is the increased postage costs due to the federal price increases. The third item that we have for PFD is what I consider a budget correction on our end. So this is $52,700, and this request is for annual computer upgrades and refreshes. So the way that we operate is that we have a four-year refresh cycle. So this $52,700 represents a quarter of the PFD staff and the need to be able to buy new equipment. Last item that we have for the PFD division is a $10,000 increment, and this is for their call center system. So the call center that we have is a shared contract between our Child Support Enforcement Division as well as PFD, and the $10,000 is represents their proportional share of that contract increase.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So quick question on the computer refresh. Since it's a regular and ongoing, why isn't it a part of the base? I thought it was in most of the budgets.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, thank you for the question. And yes, I should have touched on that. For whatever reason, PFD actually had this on the capital budget. So on the capital side, and it's different than any of our other components. We typically do see it on the operational side, but it's been funded through capital since I've been at revenue, and I think it's been that way for quite a few years before I was there as well.
Okay, so quick follow-up. So if we authorize this, move it in there, it would be the intention and the budget structure that it's in the base for that division like every other department, and it's a quarter of the department or the division at a time annually.
Yes, to the chair, Representative Hannah, that is correct. And the capital allocation that we have is no longer available.
Thank you.
Next division that we have is our Child Support Enforcement Division. So we have a big item that we have for this upcoming fiscal year is funding of the class study. So the class study that we did complete that went into effect December 25th affected 107 total positions within DOR. So this is the request to make sure that we fully fund the payroll increment that we got through that class study. The second item is just a technical change in funding sources. So this is due to an increase in federal ineligible cases. So to expand on that a little bit, so this is a Title IV program that we have that's within child support, and it's also Title IV related to OCS within health and social services. When we do child support enforcement on behalf of children in custody within OCS, by reciprocity within that program, if they're deemed ineligible at OCS, they're also deemed ineligible at CICD as well. So when we're looking at those drivers, unfortunately, I can't speak to those specific items. It's more of a question for OCS within the Department of Health, but that's what that is representing for us. Last item that we have is the call center system contract that is also the same one that we had for PFD. Difference is just the cost is higher for CSED, and that's just a function of it's a much, much larger division than PFD is. Next on our presentation, we have the commissioner's office. We have one budget increment, and this is within interagency receipts, and this fully funds positions that were created this last year when Commissioner Crum was appointed. Fully funds a special assistant policy analyst, and also fills out the travel budget to the historical averages of what it's cost for the commissioner's office to travel and do business in the state of Alaska.
Question, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, through the chair. So those two were new positions when Commissioner Crum came on as commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes.
And could you, and both positions are currently, excuse me, Mr. Chair, follow-up question. Both positions are currently filled?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes, so this, I'm sorry, let me back up. No, one of them has actually resigned. So we had two filled, and right now only one is.
Follow-up, which of the positions, and can you tell me the name of the person, or is that an inappropriate question?
Through the chair, Representative Adam, I don't see an issue with it, but yeah, that's so this is our is a special assistant to the commissioner, too, that is filled, and it's filled by Llewellyn Smythe up in the Anchorage office.
And then one more. The policy analyst position, what is the scope of the policies that they're doing work on that necessitated a new position being added when CRIM? I assume that there are other policy analysts within the department already.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we didn't have any other policy-related positions. There used to be, if we look at historical org charts, the commissioner's office used to be larger than it was when Commissioner Crum took his took his office. I'm blanking on dates. I apologize. But yes, there used to be more positions, and it's basically building this out. And as part of this ask, we're actually removing a deputy commissioner position. We actually stood up a second deputy commissioner initially as well, as we're reevaluating the needs of the department. That is one technical change that we're making in our budget, is deleting that position and just having these two items. The policy analyst position, or the policy position, is currently vacant. And as far as I know, and I know we have Commissioner Crum online, I don't think we're actively looking to fill that position at the moment. And Commissioner Crum, if you wanted to chime in on this, welcome you too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, through the chair. This is Commissioner Crum. So, yeah, the policy analyst position is currently open. What we're hoping to look at is we've got a number of items that are being pursued with the carbon credit legislation from last year, as well as the carbon sequestration, and a number of different items going forward when it comes to energy issues, was to make sure that we were built up and had the capacity to help respond to questions and concerns, both from the governor's office as well as the legislature, to address those items to come forward and to really kind of build back up the Department of Revenue's capacity to respond, as opposed to be a reactive agency.
And then follow up. Thank you, through the chair. So when, if we've done away with a deputy commissioner position, will we show a deduction somewhere else in the ad here?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hammond, the $456,000 is a cumulative representation of those pluses and minuses within our budget. Okay. So to fully fund all the positions, and just anecdotally, it was over $600,000 before the deletion of the deputy commissioner.
Okay, thank you.
Very good, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The special assistant position, was that filled last year?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, I want to say yes, it was filled. I do not recall when Llewellyn actually joined our team. Commissioner Crum, do you remember the hire date? I apologize.
It was during a portion of last year. I don't remember exactly when that did occur. For the record, this is Commissioner Crum.
But, and what I'm getting to, Mr. Chair, is why weren't some of these included in the governor's December 15 budget? Why were they brought, I guess, between December 15 and February 15, which was just last week? Only 2 months have gone by, and just curious as to why that, and actually a lot of the expenses in here that are in the amended budget were included. Just curious as to, you know, it seems like some of these things we probably knew about before December 15, and I know that one way to keep the appearance of the budget down, the December 15 one, which is the one that most people pay attention to, is, you know, you can go through and put in the amended adjustments later, and it's just one of the things that's always irked me over the past. So I guess, did we know about these before December 15?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Foster. Yes, we did. And it's a kind of an iterative process that we work through with OMB. So with this this ask right here, you can see that it's funded with interagency or billable receipts within our component. When we were having these conversations, we were talking about what was the most appropriate method of funding. And that's the reason why I would say it would be delayed, is that we were working with OMB to try to get, you know, final budget item together for this ask.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make the comments. It's one of the things that over the years I've always been a little troubled by. I see some of the things in here, for example, you know, whether it's needing to update our some of our software or whatever it might be. And you know, I just always feel like those are things that really should go into the first version of the budget if we know about it, because I've always felt like that's one way to, you know, keep the budget down, and you come in later with amendments and bring it up when people aren't really paying attention. And I just want to put that on the record, because I really want all the different departments to know that that's something that I'm going to start bringing up more often. So thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I'm going to hand the gavel back to Co-Chair Johnson. And we have a pending question with Representative Galvin.
Okay. I don't know where we're at here. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, through the chair. And I think this may be more of a general question for Commissioner Crum. I very much appreciate your comments about needing to ensure that there's staffing on the revenue side when it comes to thinking about some of our energy policy challenges coming up. And I know even recently there was some discussion and questions about modeling. And I very much understand that there's going to be a lot of need for that as some big time decisions are coming down, or the modeling of what each project might look like from the tax division side. And I just wondered if your tax department has all of what it needs to deliver that, as opposed to a policy analysis. Like, if you, I'm just not sure if you have what you need to cover the possible challenges coming soon from your tax division, and if that's already written within this budget or not.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin. I thank you very much, Rep. Galvin, for that question. And it is something we struggle with. Currently, we do have quite a bit of talent and capacity at the economic research group within the Division of Tax. But as we have some of these very large lingering questions, which we're trying to address with the Gov's office as well as the legislative branch and sister agencies, that is something we're continually to look at as these questions move forward, as other projections. Right now, I'd say we are capable of responding on when it comes to the specific fiscal modeling that it needs to come out of the ERG group. But as we kind of proceed, this is something we'll have consistent conversations on with the Gov office. And one thing that we've done to try to make sure we've got capacity across the board is work very closely with the Department of Natural Resources and some of the economists that they have to make sure that we are sharing of resources and or working together or not duplicating efforts to make sure that the product we put out is meeting the need and responsive. And I'd say the policy analyst position for the state is the commissioner's office is part of that goal is to help make sure that while we do fiscal modeling, that we are also putting it together in the right way in both available statutory authority or required statutory need or change to inform the Gov office as well as the legislature for possible change.
Thank you. Thank you.
The next division, for the record, Eric Tomolin, Admin Services Director for the Department of Revenue. The next division that we have is Admin Services Division. We've got two items, the first one being an increment of $499,000 to fund the PCNs that we received from DOA as part of the help desk position transfer. The second ask that we have is for IT manager to manage the help desk positions as they're coming over, as well as be a IT manager for the department, be able to oversee IT projects and initiatives through the Department of Revenue. Next unit is the Criminal Investigations Unit. We have their one item for this year is for $39,000. The way that we do budgets each and every year is we have a projected vacancy factor that's built into our budgets each and every year. And in cases where you have a small unit, this is a component of only eight FTEs as it stands right now. They're luckily fully staffed. So because we budget just a natural vacancy factor cumulatively within the budget, we just don't have enough money in this particular pot to pay a fully staffed unit, and that's what this ask is for. So the next,
excuse me, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did receive a note, and before we get too far away from the other slide that I was referring to when we were talking about, the special assistant. And it sounds like that was in the December 15 budget, but it's listed in here as being under the governor's amended budget, which those amendments were due, I believe, February 15. I guess I'm just trying to figure out, was it in the original budget or is it a new budget amendment for that maybe some of these other items, or am I missing something?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Foster. This is government as a title is just the most recent budget with the decisions that have came across. So it's a combination of what was included in December 15 and amend. So I'm sorry if I convoluted that a little bit.
Okay, so some of these are new items and some of them are not. It's just kind of mixed. Is that
correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Back to page, I guess, 16.
So the next component that we have for presentation is Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And online today, we have the CEO of the trust, Mr. Steve Williams, who will then go through slides 16 through 19.
Good afternoon. This is Steve Williams, CEO for the Alaska Mental Health Trust, for the record. On slide 16 is just a high-level overview of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we presented to the committee at the end of January on the Alaska Mental Health Trust, but this just highlights some accomplishments from FY23 for the committee's reference. Next slide, page 17. This is the high-level overview of the FY25 budget for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and as you can see, there is an increase of $167,700 over FY24. These are for increases related to things like our scheduled laptop replacement, increases in personnel costs, and then also just increases in things like supplies and services that are outside of our budget control. The next slide 18. Now moving into the office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office, which is a component of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. We provide the administrative oversight for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office. Stephanie Wheeler is the actual executive director of the office, and she's online should there be any questions. But this gives you a high-level overview of what that office does. They're responsible for taking complaints and investigating them from residents of assisted living homes and skilled nursing home facilities. You can see that there are some accomplishments there in the middle where they're actually resolving about 80% of the complaints that they receive to the satisfaction of the residents. And the challenges for this office is they haven't had that increase in staffing for over 10 years. We know the senior population is increasing. We also know that the provider capacity is increasing. There's increases in skilled nursing home facility beds as well as assisted living home facility beds statewide. Next slide, please. Slide 19 shows you that there's the request for $133,500 of GFMH for FY25. These funds would replace one-time federal funds that have been used for a position within the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office that would expire at the end of June. So without this increment, the staffing at the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office is going to be reduced. And again, from the previous slide, you can see the work that they've done, and you can see that a reduced capacity will certainly impact the ability to get out statewide to take these complaints and then do the investigations and then resolve those that need to be resolved. This request was a recommendation of the Board of Trustees. It was not included in the governor's proposed or amended, so I'm just calling that out for the committee. And with that, Madam Chair, I believe I am finished with the slides that I was going to present.
Thank you. Yes, we have a question from Representative Benjamin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Mr. Williams, we had you before the committee at least a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, perhaps it was. with you online and maybe a question to direct to Mr. Dumoulin or perhaps the commissioner. I'm back on page 4 just looking at the org chart and wondering, in terms of the decisions that the budget decisions made that affect the Mental Health Trust Authority or HFC or the Permanent Fund Corporation, the Muni Bond Bank, can someone describe to me the flow of the decision making at the governor's office? Does this go from these quasi-independent organizations through the commissioner's office to OMB and then onwards? Is that how the budget decisions are made?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Edgemond. When we're looking at the corporations, they run fairly independently. So we work with, as an admin services division within DOR, we are primarily functioning as a budget coordinator. And so we will assist on the technical items of getting the budget items actually put through an informal change record detail request. But in terms of their process, the authority has their trustees, Alaska Housing Finance Corp has their process, right? And then the APFC has their board that governs and it kind of suggests budgetary actions or what they would like to see. And all those kind of flow through those entities. And then Commissioner Crum, if you'd like to weigh in on your part of that process.
For the record, they had to wait to get unmuted. Thank you. For the record, this is Commissioner Crum, through the chair. That's pretty much how the process goes, is the independent agencies, the boards or trustees will put together their budget requests, and then that gets submitted to the department, and then we pass that over to OMB. There is no deliberating that we do occur at the commissioner's office level within the department. It is passed on to the Office of Management and Budget for consideration and deliberation with the governor's office.
Madam Co-Chair, just a quick sort of concluding comment. And I asked that question because it's been 3 years now or maybe even more running about a couple of capital budget items in the Mental Health Trust Authority that have been denied that relate to homelessness and housing. And one would think that there was a legitimate purpose behind all that, and there must be other factors involved. But I just want to take the opportunity to figure out how that gets decided, because somebody has to make that decision, right? It comes from the Mental Health Trust Authority to the broader government / OMB. And I think that's the clarification that responds to my question, or answers my question.
For the record, Eric DeMullen, Admin Services Director for the Department of Revenue. The next division that we have, or the next corporation, is Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And I do believe we have a representative from the corporation online to speak to their items. We only got the one item for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Brian Butcher, CEO, Executive Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Slide 20, we have primarily a status quo budget this year. The one item is funds we're receiving from the Mental Health Trust Authority, $200,000 of MTAR and $200,000 of general fund mental health dollars for implementing the recommendations of their trustees to expand the Department of Corrections discharge incentive grants. And what this program is it helps individuals coming out of the correctional system to find housing over a short period of time. It's limited to a couple of years, and this would expand it outside of the more urban areas to the rural areas. This program has been very successful. If you look historically at what the recidivism rates of Alaskans getting out of the correctional system, it's been about 66% both nationally and in Alaska. The folks that have gone through this system, it's around 33%. So not only are we helping transition people getting out of the system into society more effectively as a result of the benefits of housing, but that's also, in theory, Alaskans that aren't becoming victims of crimes because these crimes aren't being committed. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
I'm sorry.
Representative Yalman? I'm sorry, Representative
Kalam, followed by Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So I was just wondering, sounds like a good program, but it's 200 UGF and 200 MDAR. Can you tell me what the money goes toward? Are you actually, you know, buying properties, giving loans? Like, how are you helping people get into housing?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, the department, as it's been previously run, has been primarily vouchers. We have voucher programs that are used to benefit a number of different groups. Alaskans aging out of the foster care system, and certain areas that there's needed a focus that don't fall under the normal HUD programs. And so these dollars would look for an expansion of that. We would, assuming the funds are approved, go out with an RFP and then go from there in terms of where the benefits would be. But the focus would be on housing. Because when you think about somebody getting out of the system that may not have a network of family support or a job, if they don't have a place to live, it's not hard to figure out potentially what may happen. They may end up right back into their same habits. And so we've seen that having, even just for a two-year period, housing to stabilize them allows them to go out and get jobs and put them in a position where they don't end up reoffending.
I have a follow-up. So just to follow up with that, are the vouchers, so it sounds like it's a voucher to pay for possibly a rent for 2 years, or are you helping people actually get into their own home or apartment?
I'm sorry, they kind of broke up. It was broken up here a little bit, Mr. Chairman. Could I hear the question again?
Sure. So I'm just asking, are the vouchers for rent payments, or are you actually getting these people into their own homes or apartments permanently?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, it's a temporary program. We work with a couple of nonprofits that specialize in this, and we work through them, but it's temporary. It's housing available when they get out of the system, but it's only for a finite period of time where they have to then transition into living on their own.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through Chair Johnson. Mr. Butcher, can you tell me, I'm a little thrown off, the slide refers to these incentive grants, FY16 to FY25. So has it been $400,000 over a 10-year period and we're asking to renew it?
An expansion. Through the chair, Representative, it has been, I think it's been $100,000 a year in previous years, so this would be an expansion of it beyond the more urban areas to serve some of the smaller communities in the state.
Follow-up. For a one fiscal year span, and how many people do we think it will help? Or give vouchers to?
Through the chair, we do not know at this point. A lot will depend on the discussions with the partners, depending on the dollars available and how many we'll be able to serve. So we can look into it and try to give you a ballpark on what we think it may be, but I can't off the top of my head make that prediction.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. I guess we're on page 21.
For the record, Eric DeMullen, Admin Services Director for the Department of Revenue. Next up, we have the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I do believe we have Devin Mitchell online for questions, but we have their primary bulleted or cost driver items. They have a 6% merit increase asked for this year for $920,000, incentive comp for $915,000. Supporting a data center relocation project of $150,000, increased travel for $100,000, and increment for facilities rent, training, and advisory support.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair. So earlier we heard about another department getting a 5% merit increase. Now this one is at 6%. I assume that is to be competitive in the marketplace, but I have to ask because I'm seeing so many different increases in salaries throughout all of these departments. And also I'm also seeing more travel again. And this is a supplemental budget, as I understand it, so we somehow didn't have anticipation of that, maybe, or could you explain that part to me as well?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Galvin. This is our FY25 budget, not supplemental.
Thank you.
Item, just as we're going through this.
It's amended.
I do have Devin Mitchell on the line, the CEO of the corporation, and I would defer to him to speak to the 6% or where they came to that figure and why it is represented at 6 as opposed to 5 or otherwise.
Thank you.
Mr. Mitchell, did you hear the question?
I did. Thank you. For the record, this is Devin Mitchell, CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And as it relates to the merit increase, the 6% figure that's in your packet, that was a board-driven target that when we look at our staff and the needs to compensate staff to remain competitive, it's a little bit different calculus than you might have for other agencies, because we're not just comparing ourselves to other governmental entities, but in addition, the financial sector in general. Obviously, our salaries don't compare to the salaries that exist in the private sector for employees of private firms that invest money similarly to the employees that we have at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. But we want to be as competitive as possible in the space so that we ensure that we have the highest probability of both recruiting as well as retaining employees that have the best aptitude and highest probability of providing the strong investment performance that we've experienced historically into the future, so that the state of Alaska has the revenues that are provided through the percent of market value transfer.
Follow up, if I may. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Thank you very much. I appreciate hearing that answer, Mr. Mitchell. I wondered if you could share, what is your vacancy rate right now in this department? Is this a crisis situation or a concern of yours currently?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, our vacancy rate is actually not that bad. I think right now we're for total positions around 12%. And so what the primary driver of our budget request is to ensure that we retain employees and that we continue to compare at least we're comparable, meaning we're on the same field as some of the comparable employers for staff like ours, meaning that when you start looking around at other governmental entities like the California pension systems, the PERS or STRS systems, or some of the Texas retirement systems or sovereign wealth fund type entities, or some of the other peers that we compare ourselves to, our staff is still relatively modestly compensated, even though when you look at them in isolation in comparison to other employees that work for the state in some capacity, our employees are on the higher end.
One final. Thank you. Do the employees, the new hires, also get defined benefits?
Is
that a factor for your hiring and recruitment?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I don't think that the class of employee is as impacted. Certainly, it depends on which side you're talking about, because we have employees in the investment space that make larger salaries, and I think it's less impactful, the defined benefit discussion that you're referring to. Some of the staff that we have on the operational side, I think it's more important too, where they have more modest salaries, and some of those concerns in the space where you're considering being a long-term employee of an organization start to bring pressure to bear. And so our approach has been that we want to ensure that we pay our staff a good living wage, and that we're able to attract and retain the most qualified, the best performers that we're able to, so that we ensure that our program is successful.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Mitchell, I'm going to draw your attention. My questions pertain to the bottom two things on this slide in particular, and this is not going to surprise you. The cost of operating the Anchorage satellite office at a $100,000 increase in travel and $56,000 for rent and technology. Is that the entirety of the cost to operate the Anchorage satellite office for offices, ignoring salary and benefits? And is this the permission?
Through the chair, Representative Shanna. So the numbers you refer to aren't entirely for the impact or due to the impact of the opening of the Anchorage office. We do have some additional lease costs. It's approximately $35,000 for the space that we currently have rented in Anchorage. There is an increment for IT costs that are estimated at $25,000. We do have additional travel. We have that increment of $100,000. Some of that just relates to inflation in the travel sector, and some of it does specifically relate to the Anchorage office, maybe a 50-50 split. And so we'd have to parse it apart a little bit more to tease out the specifics of the Anchorage office. There are financial impacts related to the Anchorage office, but it's not necessarily each of the items that you're seeing an increment in today.
Thank you. And guess, Madam Chair, my request would be I'd like to see that parceled out to have a cost for the satellite office, especially if we decide to approve it, because I think the following fiscal year, we would be asking to see a return on that investment of opening a satellite office, having a cost of $150,000, I'm just kind of ballparking it, and whether that has produced the results we've wanted, and if not, then it's a cost that we shouldn't continue to carry. But it's kind of lumped in there, and I'd like to see it parceled out so that we have a clear delineation of what it's going to cost us for a full fiscal year, because we did not have a conversation about it at all last year.
All right, thank you, Representative Hannon. What I will do, we have the revenue subcommittee. I mean, I don't believe you're on it, but we will get that information. It will make it available to our revenue subcommittee members when we're working through budget amendments, but I will also make sure that you have that available and rest of the committee too as we come up with that.
Yeah, just to follow on the line of questioning that just came from Representative Hannon. Mr. Mitchell, the Anchorage office is open right now. It's functional. These budget items are sort of supplementary in nature, not sort of core to the operations of the office. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, we went back as far as the rent for the office. We did ask for an increment in this year's budget. For that, we used a one-time funding source for the cost of that rent during the current fiscal year. So these are, I think, some the increments that you see are the totality of what we expect to spend on a prospective basis. Certainly we've had some other incidental costs. We had to buy some chairs and people have to be able to sit down. We had a couple of other expenditures this fiscal year to get that office set up for staff. but I think that we can, if your question is that you want to get to the total number for the cost of the Anchorage office, we can tailor our response to that.
Well, I guess, Madam Co-Chair, what I'm just trying to get at is that the office is up and running. There's employees up there right now. You know.
Yes.
Sorry,
I misunderstood your, again, through the chair, Representative Edgman, I misunderstood your question. Yes, we have the office up and running, and we have employees in the space.
Through the co-chair, that just gets to the point of, you know, that sort of that line between a quasi-independent corporation and the powers of appropriation of the legislature and spending authority and decision making and this, that, and the other, recognizing that the board has the authority to make the decision. But I don't sit on the subcommittee, and I'll certainly delegate that responsibility to the co-chair who chairs it to get more in depth. But I'm going to leave this conversation with a few unanswered questions, and probably best for me to come back, Mr. Mitchell, either to you offline or maybe to the co-chair once the subcommittee reports back to the full committee, because I don't really have a clear picture yet of how this all transacted.
And as I recall, I want to say that when we did have the permanent fund, board member, I think the president and this Mr. Mitchell was before us, we did have a discussion a bit about how this transpired, and I think the biggest concern had been that we'd put it in one line item, appropriated to one line item, and it'd been used for another line item. But we haven't had this discussion fully at the subcommittee level yet.
For the record, Eric DeMolin, Admin Services Director for the Department of Revenue. Just to wrap up APFC, the last item that we have for them is just investment management fees of $2.8 million. These are fees that we pay just to manage assets, and they tend to be correlated with the size of the fund directly itself. All right. As we get into the next section of our presentation, this is a slide that was presented by OMB as part of the statewide budget presentation for operational challenges. We wanted to expand on that with some of the issues, challenges, and some of the items we've done at the Department of Revenue to try to mitigate operational impacts to our agency. So taking a different look at vacancy, we've heard vacancy discussed quite a bit. This chart here shows positions filled as opposed to vacancy. Wanted to be able to show it in a couple of different ways because vacancy has a changing denominator. So when we're looking at historical vacancy trends, I think it could be a little bit misleading on how impactful vacancy rates are today. So when we're looking at just our trends, we can see that we are starting to climb up a little bit more. We're well below average, and we're significantly below what we would consider to be fully staffed for like an optimum agency operationally. And as we look at kind of what makes up those numbers, the top five vacant job classes that we are experiencing within DOR, the accounting technicians, child support specialists, office assistants, and PFD technicians, along with tax technicians. The child support specialists, making up that green bar chart, was the one category we were able to make some changes in for this year. The class study we just had completed allowed for a two-range increment, so we're hoping to see that gap narrow. And it took us about 2.5 years to be able to get that. From identifying the issue to getting it implemented was about 2.5 years. The next slide that we have is our hires and resignations. So when we look at each one of our divisions, we can see that we have a high amount of hires, resignations within our larger divisions, with child support and tax. We see that decreases, you know, relative to size of our divisions. But what is nice to be able to see through FY23 is that we're hiring more than we're losing. So we've seen a reversal in the trend that we've had in the last couple of years.
Through the chair, on this slide, I'm reminded of particularly the tax division and a couple subjects. One was keeping and retaining, or rather hiring and retaining auditors, I guess, for lack of a better word, to do timely returns or to review filings from the industry, and not result in the imposition of penalties that perhaps they weren't responsible for. I may be not remembering how the flow of that work goes precisely, but there was a concern with vacancies in the audit division. I think that's sort of aligned with the tax division in some way. But can you tell us, my question is twofold. How is the vacancy in audit and tax? And are we reviewing the tax returns from the oil industry in a timely way, or are we still backed up?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson, thank you very much for the question. That granular level of detail I don't have just as part of this presentation here. It's something that we do track. I do believe that Director Brandon Spanos is on the line to be able to speak to how they're managing just their tax audits. Brandon, if you're online, do you mind weighing in on the question?
Yes, this is Acting Director Brandon Spanos with the Tax Division. And I believe the question was in regard to our oil and gas group and that audit function. We do have many auditors within the Tax Division over multiple programs. We administer over 20 different tax programs. The oil and gas production tax is one of those. And it has been discussed in years past about the six-year statute of limitations with the oil and gas program and how long it was taking auditors to complete those cycles. So I believe that's where the question's focused. In the oil and gas group, I don't have that information directly in front of me, but we certainly have had turnover. We lose some of our best and brightest auditors to industry because industry pays a lot more for those folks. And so when those folks come over and do audits, they can recognize our best and brightest, and they can cherry pick them, unfortunately. So we do have a deal with the turnover there, but in general, we also have a lot of longevity in that group, especially folks that are on some of the earlier tier retirement programs. They look at that as a benefit and tend to stick with us, even if they are offered more to go somewhere else, if you know they're closer to retirement, for instance. The math just doesn't work out quite the same for somebody who's newer and on tier four. But in regard to the question on how are we doing in our audit cycles, we have undertaken over the years an effort to close that cycle. We never were. It was implied that we were behind in our audits, but because of the six-year statute of limitations, we never did miss any of our deadlines. But I think taxpayers were frustrated because interest does continue to accrue. If we assess you know, 5 years later, that you're paying interest back to the due date of the tax return. And so it is better to do a quicker cycle. We are nearly caught up to a three-year audit cycle now, which is consistent with our other tax programs. I'd have to, I don't have any numbers in front of me, but I was told the other day that we are almost caught up to that three-year cycle.
First of all, I want to thank the director. That was very, very thorough and responsive to my question. What I'm curious about is classification studies that might help. Did any of the studies that we addressed earlier in the slide deck affect your employees in your section? The 107 workers or whatever it was.
So through the chair, Representative Josephson, we were not included in any of the class studies.
So. Follow up. What do you know about whether you will be in the future?
Through the chair, I'd probably defer that to Director DeMolin. We've had those conversations, but my understanding is there's a quite a bit backlog, and it would take years to have that study done.
Yeah, for the record, Admin Services Director Eric DeMolin, you know, Brandon's exactly right. We've had these conversations, and what what we're doing actually right now is trying to focus on what we have within our purview to try to manage directly in terms of recruitment and retention. And the increment that DOA got last year to fund a salary study, we're hopeful is going to address the issues when we're looking at salary, because that's intended to be statewide. So right now I could say that, you know, we're not in a specific queue for a classification study on specific positions. We're waiting for, hopefully, that salary study to be completed and address some of these issues.
And I guess I should.
Yeah. I do want to get through the presentation if we.
I should know more about, and really a DOA question maybe about salary studies vis-a-vis classification studies. I'll look up one. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay.
The next illustration we have are just what is happening with our employees. So when we're looking at departing employees, we were just looking at hires versus resignations. Wanted to point out just what we're seeing in terms of trend within our department is that the majority of people are leaving the state in terms of finding employment elsewhere. And we're seeing most of our turnover within the first 12 months. This slide looks a little bit busy, but I think it's got some good information just to be able to look at your leisure. Spoke to a little bit about vacancy versus filled counts, right? And I think that, you know, although like correlated, you could definitely see a correlation between vacancy and filled rates over time. But when we're looking just cumulatively on some of our programs, like the Permanent Fund Dividend Division as an example, right, when we're looking at 2018 and the high 60s to be able to functionally manage that program and applications, and going down to the last 2 years of 53, that delta on frontline workers on a technical aspect, if they're processing applications, is pretty impactful operationally. So just a couple of things of what we do know is that filled positions are rebounding. They're well below average or what we would consider to be fully employed in order to be able to accomplish our mission in the most effective way. Our distributions among the programs is not equal. CSED clearly has a very high vacancy rate compared to other divisions that we have. It's followed by PFD and tax divisions, and those are specifically in those technical job classes. And the vacancy distribution that we're seeing is primarily between the range 10 to range 14 area.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. My understanding is that ranges 12 to 14 is you're competing with McDonald's and Starbucks and the grocery store. That range anyway, it is apparently just a really tough range. And I think that's why you popped up two ranges in the child support division. Is that accurate? I just want to make sure I have that close.
Yeah, to the chair, Representative Galvin. It is close, right? When we're looking at these lower range positions, we have seen wage inflation. So we are now competing with what we would consider to be more entry level positions that are more prominent. So right now, just it's expanded that opportunity, right, for employees to be able to look elsewhere.
Thank you. Would it be fair to say that the people that are in the 12 to 14 step range tend to be more transient? I mean, they're just at the lower end of the, maybe in the early part of their career or at the lower, not in a professional position.
Co-Chair Johnson, I would agree with that. So when we're looking at these lower ranges, you would anticipate seeing a high turnover rate. People get a job, they become proficient, they build their skill sets, they then move on with their careers. So a high turnover rate, when we're looking at these, are kind of by design, right? So these range 10, 12, 14 are entry-level positions. You would expect to see that. What we don't always expect to see, though, is a prolonged vacancy period where we're not getting anybody through. So high turnover is one thing that we would expect to see. However, not being able to fill the positions at all causes another issue altogether. Right. So a couple of things of just what we've been able to do just at DOR is that we were successful in working with the Department of Administration in implementing that two-range increase that will be a benefit to 107 of our positions. It's pretty sizable when we're looking at budgeted PCNs for the Department of Revenue. We were also able to have a similar success just changing office assistants by job class to administrative assistants. There's also a pay increment there. And those are some of our more entry-level positions. So that marginal benefit goes a long way. And so we're seeing a lot of benefit to those two actions. We've been leveraging telework to try to be more telework-friendly as an organization, hopefully helping with the recruitment and retention there. And we've been able to get one dedicated full-time HR position to help with timely recruiting. I know those positions came back from DOA as well, and that's worked out really well for our organization. And we've been very proactive in trying to attend job fairs. The Department of Labor has been sending out notifications of job fairs to all the administrative service directors. We've been very proactive in trying to send HR to go to these job fairs, trying to generate some interest for the Department of Revenue. We've been trying to partner with universities both in the University of Alaska system in Fairbanks and Anchorage and trying to setting up internship programs and trying to engage on that level as well. And so other than that, we're just trying to make sure that our division directors, leadership, they all have access to this type of data to be able to make, you know, data-driven decisions to hopefully manage what we can internally. To
all right. Thank you. We have vacancy issues. Thank you. We have a question from Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to let you get through your presentation. But I did have a question on page 17. There's a little table there saying unspent personal services adds up to like $18 million on slide 17. Well, it says 17 on mine. Is this...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
There it is. Thank you. Corner table. So that's quite a bit unspent. So I guess I just would like you to speak to that. Are those encumbered? Are they just sitting there? Like, what is catastrophic reserve? Maybe explain some of that.
Yeah, so through the chair, Representative Cologne, this is OMB's slide that they put through. We just use it as a starting point for our presentation to get into our vacancy operations conversation. But when we're talking about personal services or that lapse, I could speak to the Department of Revenues as opposed to statewide. But when we're looking at what happens with our revenue, generally it would just lapse and it would then just be swept back into the general fund and reappropriated the next year. So depending on funding source.
And then follow-up?
Okay, follow-up.
I didn't see it on a slide, but in the budget book, there's a reference to $150,000 to relocate APFC's Disaster Recovery Data Center from Fairbanks to Anchorage. If you have somebody who could speak to that, why are we moving it? What is that?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Cologne, that's an initiative that APFC has been having for a while to move the data center redundancies from Fairbanks to Anchorage. And I believe that's driven by just data connectivity issues. Like, Anchorage is just a better location. We do have Devin Mitchell still online. Mr. Mitchell, were you able to weigh in on that $150,000 ask for the data center?
Mr. Mitchell, did you hear the question? Let's see. I do show that he's still online. I don't know if he has heard the question.
Yeah, though. I don't know if he has anything more to really
add. I'm sorry. This is Devin Mitchell again. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, for the record, this is Devin Mitchell, CEO of the Permanent Fund Corporation. And that's correct. It was a move that's been predicated upon poor connectivity in a facility that we have been using in Fairbanks. It's a disaster redundancy system so that in the event that there were some issue in the Juneau office that we wouldn't lose the ability to conduct business of the corporation. And we've been in the process of relocating to Anchorage. We have a site that we've been working on and hope to be implemented at that site in the next 6 months at this point.
Good, thank you.
All right, very good, thank you. I am going to go ahead and end our, are there any, I don't know, you're finished with your presentation, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and end our presentation there, as we have a number of things before us this afternoon. And we will have an opportunity to discuss any additional questions, or some of the questions that already came up. We'll be able to talk about those in subcommittee as well. So let me talk about what our next meeting. Our next meeting is tomorrow, 8:30 a.m. Let's hope it's not a long night. The committee will hear HB 83 regarding the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Management Areas in Alaska, HB 145 regarding payday loans, and HB 174, an act restricting fiduciary actions. Seeing no further business before the committee, at 3:03, we are adjourned.